They say the only sure things are death and taxes, but you still can be taxed after death. Did you know that? You can't take it with you, but can you still decide where and to whom it goes? Well, in her new book, Immortality and the Law, Ray D. Madoff examines what kinds of rights the dead and will lay claim to and how that affects the rest of us. It's published by Yale University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Madoff of Boston College Law School to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
And before we begin, your name is spelt the same as a notorious investor here in New York, a Ponzi scheme man. Are you related in any way?
Not related at all. Not related. Don't know him. Never met him.
What got you thinking about the kinds of rights that the dead have?
Well, this is the area that I teach in, the area of wills and trusts and things like that. And I was interested in this question about why people care so much about the ability to control property at death, and why is the estate tax, why is the death tax language so effective? And because after all, you're dead. So you would think that you wouldn't care so much about these things. But of course, these opportunities to control property after death afford people this little bit of immortality. It's almost like a consolation prize. You know, you might be gone, but don't worry, your wishes are still going to be respected.
And I've spoken to people who are frustrated by that. In one case, somebody who's father had not trusted her mother and her to handle the money well and put together a whole group of people who controlled it. And she was controlled for years and not allowed to spend her own money.
That's right. And what's interesting is that this approach that's taken in the United States is so different from the approach taken in other parts of the world. If she had been in another part of the world, then she would have had a direct right to a significant portion of the decedent's property. So different countries take very different approaches.
And she saw it very much as her father being controlling in life and wanting to be controlling in death as well.
Absolutely. And that's the question that is interesting, when people are allowed to do that.
Well, so why the United States and not other countries?
Well, I don't know. I think that the United States, there's a number of factors that are involved. The United States, of course, is very much tied into this idea of property. And so the ability to control property and individual rights, that we are each a rugged individualist and not a part of our family, are very strong concepts here.
Does it vary from state to state, or is there a kind of a federal overview?
Well, the state law varies, but what's happened in a number of these areas is that there's been a race to the bottom, and that states that that are on the extremes are really able to control things throughout much of the country. So, for example, one of the things that I talk about a lot in the book are these dynasty trusts. These are the trusts that where people can control property now forever. And although there's only 14 states that allow you to set them up forever, anybody can set up a trust by simply hiring the bank to be the trustee from one of those states.
But sometimes it gets kind of messy. The Barnes Foundation, for example,
yes,
is fighting to keep the Barnes collection in a small town, hard to get to town outside of Philadelphia. The people of Philadelphia feel that the collection should be made available to everyone. But Barnes said in a will he wrote in 1921 or 22,
mm-hmm,
that it had to be kept out there. What is it, Merriam?
Yes, I think that's where it is. And the Barnes Foundation raises really interesting questions about the ability to control property after death. We tell people in the charitable trust context that you can control property forever. And so Barnes believed that his wishes were going to be upheld. And he had lots of reason to believe it because that's what the law says. However, when you have property that's as valuable as the Barnes property, you are just bound to get lots of interested parties involved who make their wishes known. And so, in fact, his wishes were undermined, as frankly a lot of donors are. And I think that one of the lessons that I hope people take from the book is this idea that forever, well, it's a very nice concept, really doesn't work the way people think it's going to.
Hasn't most of our law evolved from British law?
It does. But what's interesting is that although our source is British law, we have moved much more towards giving power to the dead than the British ever had. And people think it's just the opposite. People tend to think of as England as the place where there's lots of dead hand control, and the United States as being a place of equality. But instead, England has moved away to giving more powers to the living and really cutting off dead hand control, and the United States has saved those powers.
And what has caused that? What's led to that? Are there religious considerations? Are there medical considerations that developed over the years that affected lawmakers?
I think that in part what happened is that because our forebears, those establishing the rules in this country, were mindful of the concerns of dead hand control, we as later generations don't realize the cost of it. We haven't been as sensitized to how bad dead hand control can be. In England, they lived with dead hand control for much longer, and so their in England are saying, well, no, dead hand control is a bad thing, and they try to move
control?
Away from it.
That's where the only, as I understand it, the way you're telling it, the eldest got all of them the property, or is that something else?
No, that was something. Dead hand control is the ability of dead people to decide what's going to happen to property. So, for example, to go back to the example of your friend with the trust, the question is, if somebody sets up a trust with all sorts of restrictions, you know, how can that be changed? Well, in England, the beneficiaries, the living beneficiaries, can all get together and petition the court and say, we want to change it, because after all, we're the living people. We're the only people in interest. Here in the United States, the law says, no, the dead person still has an interest. And if they left those restrictions on, it doesn't make any difference what the living people want.
Is this because we view the dead person in a different way than people do elsewhere, in the same way that we view a corporation as a person?
Well, I think that's very much related. What's interesting is that if you study the laws of different countries, you see that they grant rights to the dead in accordance with what the country most values. So, for example, in France, where the artist is very much valued, artists have a lot of control after death about how their work is going to be shown and whether their name's associated with it and things like that. Here in the United States, we value the property owner. So while the artist has very little control over how his work is shown, the person who owns the painting has full control. They can decide to bury it in their basement or tear it up, and the artist has virtually no control. So different countries grant different rights to different people in the country.
My guest is Ray D. Madoff. Her book, Immortality and the Law, The Rising Power of the American Dead. What about immortality? We have the whole matter of cryonics, don't
yes.
we? And that leads to some crazy stuff. There was a lot in the newspapers a few years ago about Ted Williams' body being frozen, and he hadn't even wanted that.
Well, that's right. It was unclear what exactly he wanted. They had found basically a grease-stained piece of paper written on which it was written that we would like to be frozen together. Even if it can't be true, we want to hold on to this hope, something like that. And it was signed Ted Williams and also signed by his two children. Now, of course, Ted Williams had left instructions in his will about what he wanted done with his body. And the instructions in his will was that he wanted to be cremated and he wanted his ashes to be sprinkled off the coast of Florida where the water was deep. It sounds very peaceful. However, his children brought forth this sort of grease-stained piece of paper, and they said, no, what Dad wanted was to be frozen with us so that we could all be reanimated together. And there was quite a court dispute about what was ultimately going to happen. And as you mentioned, he was, in fact, frozen. What's interesting is that...
Well, in this case, he didn't have control after his death.
Well, that's right. And the reason is that while we grant lots of control over property in this country, when it comes to your body, you actually have virtually no control at all. And that's really the exact opposite of what one would expect, because certainly we think if we own anything at all, it has to be the body in which we live.
Well, we know that King Tut wanted his body preserved and all the pharaohs, but I wonder whether Lenin wanted his body to be preserved or Napoleon.
That's right. And there's lots of issues, too, about what happens when there's been a change of power and what to do with, for example, Lenin's body. There were a lot of articles about...
They got rid of Stalin's body.
Right. And there have been lots of issues about the reburial and transformation of bodies after death, after burial.
How does the law view cryonics? Are there ways for people who believe in cryonics to have availed themselves of the process to preserve their assets for future use? And what happens if if there's an attempt to revive them and it doesn't work.
Right. Or even scarier, if it does work. The issue of cryonics is a really interesting one, because different countries have taken different approaches. Many countries say, forget it. This is just charlatanism, and the likelihood of being able to revive a dead person is like making a cow out of hamburger. You know, it's not going to happen, and we shouldn't therefore allow it as an industry. Now, Americans as a people tend to be very anti-death and very hopeful about things, and so I think it's not that surprising that cryonics has taken hold here in a way that it hasn't in other places and is in fact allowed throughout much of the United States.
I was thinking about you teaching at Boston College Law School. Harvard Medical School is in Boston as well, not in Cambridge with the rest of Harvard.
Yes, that was a fascinating thing. I had always noticed that it was in Boston, but I never knew why. Well, it turns out that it's a historical reason, and that is that medical schools, the formation and development of medical schools in the 19th century was very much dependent on being able to teach anatomy. And in order to teach anatomy, you needed to have bodies. But there was no way of really getting a lot of bodies. You could get bodies for people who had committed really bad crimes. If you committed a bad crime, you were killed. But if you committed a really bad crime, you were killed and your body was handed to the anatomist. But that didn't provide enough bodies for the medical schools. So medical schools had to get involved in the business themselves of bribing and digging up bodies, and all that whole grave robbery business was to provide bodies for medical schools. Well, for Harvard, they had a problem because their medical school was in Cambridge, but their prime source of bribery for bodies were the poorhouses, and those were located in Boston. And so the anatomy professor wrote to the president of the university and said, there's not a corpse to be had in Cambridge, so we have to move to Boston.
Now, there are so many different things that you deal with this, in this book, and I can't get to all of them, but there have been disputes over transplanted organs and organ donations and posthumous conception, which is different, it seems to me. The law applies differently. If I impregnate somebody and then die, it's different than if I donate my sperm used later and then die, and then I have a posthumous child?
Right. Well, the law is trying to come to terms with all of the technology today so that now having children after death is really quite easy. And so the law, because people can leave, you can leave frozen sperm, you can leave frozen embryos. They can't yet freeze eggs because they're too indelicate, but, you know, you can have a lot there. You can also exhume sperm from a dead man. So somebody who had no intention of having children and had no knowledge, hadn't banked their sperm, you can still, before you tuck them away, grab the sperm and use that for posthumous procreation. That leaves a real challenge for the law, because as these children are being born, the law has to grapple with to what extent they're going to be treated as the child of that deceased parent.
Now, if I write a will that denies any money to my spouse and my children, is that will going to hold up?
Well, certainly with respect to your children, it's not a problem. With respect to your spouse, that's going to vary very much state to state. And some states, it's very easy to avoid spouses. Other states, it's not easy at all. But with respect to your children, you can freely disinherit them, even if as a result of the disinheritance, they become wards of the state. And which is surprising because, of course, during your life, you're required to support your children.
Now, we have a whole field of law dealing with trusts and the like and attempts to get around paying taxes. But after I die, am I still going to be paying taxes?
Well, that's going to depend, of course, on what Congress does. Right now, there's no estate taxes at all. And what happens next year is pretty much up for grabs. But what people can do is they've been setting up these long-term dynasty trusts, which enable property to pass to their heirs and future heirs tax-free as it passes to each generation. And these trusts are being set up now all around the country with lots and lots of money in them. But they're going to they're really poised to change the social structure of our society, because we're going to have two classes of people. We're going to have people who are the beneficiaries of these tax-free and also creditor-proof trusts, meaning that if the beneficiaries get drunk and go out and kill somebody, those victims can't reach this trust money. And then you're going to have the rest of us who are not beneficiaries. And so it's going to be a real challenge.
You mentioned that in France, artists maintain control over their art after they die. Martin Luther King's family sued CBS for broadcasting his I Have a Dream speech without paying them. I always thought that that was public property when you make a public speech.
Right. So that is... that's a really turns out to be a lot more complicated question than you'd think. There is, when he spoke it might have been public, but actually that text is covered by copyright. And it's not only the text of his speech that's protected, but also his very image. And in creating the park at, in Washington, D.C., the memorial, they also had to pay the family in order to use Martin Luther King's image in that memorial.
Do Elvis impersonators have to pay a royalty?
Yeah, they absolutely do.
Ray D. Madoff is a professor at Boston College Law School. She's the lead author of Practice Guide to Estate Planning and has written on a wide variety of areas involving property after death. Her latest book, Immortality and the Law, The Rising Power of the American Dead, it's published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.